it was a lot of false starts, a lot of meet me at 1 a.m. I'm running a real tech business, right? You can get paid. You got to come at 4 a.m. You go at 4 a.m. and then they're not there. They won't open their door. It was crazy stuff that would happen.
Hey, co-founders, welcome to Made It with Connor Tompkins, a podcast where we meet with badass entrepreneurs who've successfully exited their companies, discussing everything from the wins and losses of entrepreneurship to the next steps after the exit. To not miss out on these exciting stories, be sure to subscribe wherever you get podcasts. Let's dive in.
Hey, everyone, I'm here with Shane Neiman. He is the founder of Junebug and also Easy Texting. And he's doing some fantastic stuff right now with Neiman Ventures, which we'll get into here in just a bit. Stay tuned, and we'll talk about humanoid robots and the Santa Monica Pier. But for the most part, I really want to jump in, Shane, into your journey as an entrepreneur and what it was like going through that exit transition. What is the premise for Junebug, and then how did you find that there is this blue ocean there?
So Junebug came out of a failed attempt at another startup. So my first startup was in 1999. We called it Offsix, and we raised some venture capital. I was actually in medical school before. I was going to NYU Med, and my roommate was working at Goldman. He was partying and making a lot of money, and I was in my room studying all the time, 24 hours a day.
That's not fair.
He was making fun of me. It was a Sunday morning. He had just come from partying at 7 a.m. And he convinced me to drop out and do a startup with him because he would raise all the millions of dollars. And I had a degree in computer science. We decided to make an ASP, which is basically now called SaaS. We tried to essentially make Microsoft 365 right now, but through using Citrix, all the Windows-based applications would be running on our servers. You get the latest version. We'd host your files. We had an app store. But we were way too early for our time. We had a great product. It worked. Dot-com bubble burst. I had saved up a couple $100,000 from programming in college. So I lost it all and I went broke and I literally moved in with my girlfriend. She was going to FIT at the time and she lived in a dorm and I was living out of a garbage bag. I started going out to nightclubs because she was doing a door at a few of the places in New York to make some money on the side. And I started looking around and I started seeing how backwards that industry really was. They were taking down things on paper. They were giving out flyers that were telling about future events that were being thrown on the floor like garbage. They had girls going around taking phone numbers and they would call people the next week to invite them. So as from a marketing and also just an operational standpoint, they were not technically advanced at all. And so to also condense that, we ended up building the tech stack for the most of the nightclubs and bars use called Junebug. A lot of people know us more for our front-facing website, which aggregated all the events that were going on in New York City and other major cities and put them on our website. And we have photographers that would go around and take pictures at events and post them. And we would collect data. And we had this huge database of people who would go out, young urban professionals with disposable income, this really elusive demographic. So we realized from that point of view on the consumer facing side, we had this advantage, but we also powered the tech that the POS, the ticketing systems, we built one. This is a pre-Eventbrite, pre-camera phone, pre-Facebook, pre-MySpace time.
You like combined like 10 different businesses into one business idea, and each of those 10 became like their own, almost like unicorn business down the road.
Yeah. And it was in an unlikely industry. So that industry is a very tough industry. You're dealing with unscrupulous people. You're dealing with short-sighted people. We did all different types of venues, big venues, even some concert venues that were too small for Ticketmaster to service. It was actually easier because it was early, because really there was no MailChimp. So like people didn't have it. I would buy servers we had an office in Chelsea. We had a rack in our office and I would buy these Cisco servers that literally we wrote our own software to load balance sending out emails across these servers because there was nothing available for us to do on our shelf.
Did you have partners with this? Like, how did this start? And then how did you get your first sales? Did you go door to door on the nightclub scene?
My girlfriend was my partner at the time. We weren't equal partners, but we were smart enough and, let's say, mature enough to not let that, even though we broke up pretty quickly into it, not to let that affect us and continue to be friends and partners. And so she had some inroads because she was working the doors at some of the clubs. And so that's what we used. And actually being a girl and guy duo really worked really well for us because inevitably whoever we were dealing with would either take to me or take to her. And so we would go to meetings together, and just when one of us was being favored, the other person would sit back and let that person lead. There was a lot of false starts, a lot of, you know, meet me at 1 a.m. I'm running a real tech business, right?
And yeah,
but we did what we had to do. We'd go, and then sometimes we'd show up and no one would be there, or the door would be closed. Even getting paid, sometimes they'll say, okay, yeah, you can get paid. You got to come at 4 a.m. You go at 4 a.m. and then they're not there, or they won't open their door. It was crazy stuff that would happen. It's kind of like being in a frat and having to be hazed and going through that hazing period until you become part of the frat. And then you get a different kind of respect. Once you become entrenched into the ecosystem, then none of that stuff is really happening to you anymore.
So Shane, essentially you had to be a pledge in the almost like the New York nightclub and multiple different markets nightclub scene.
Yes.
And then you matured over the next few years inside the society, and then they knew who you were and you knew who they were.
Then we set the terms of how we were. So no, I'm not going to come 4 a.m. Give me a credit card. You know, like everything. We normalize things a little bit more. What we also realized is because they used our software is that we saw how much money they were making. And we said, we should do events and eat our own dog food. So why don't we try that? And quickly we realized that there are two nights a year, everybody goes out and spends a lot of money, Halloween and New Year's in particular. And people will pay ungodly sums of money for New Year's because that's their like one night out and it's amateur night and they want to make the best of it. We actually started doing something that no one had ever done before, which we would rent out venues and then prepay for them and then throw an event. And we would do also unlikely places, not just like a nightclub. We would do like Dave and Buster's, right, in Times Square, because we realized that people wanted to bring their kids, and that's a place that you can bring your kids. And it's in Times Square. People would pay triple to do that. And then once we started cornering that market, we started doing really advanced things like controlling ticket prices, knowing the velocity of ticket sales, then being able to dynamically price and even being able to predict how much money we were going to make and how much profit we were going to make on a particular event. And we started doing it on a much larger scale.
There's so much involved in this. The technical side, right? You have the sales and marketing engine. You also are running these events, and each event that you do is probably has a lot of lift. Right. Not only are you helping facilitate events for other people, you're also taking it in-house. That's a lot of work. How did you guys scale? What did that look like on the people side?
Honestly, I didn't take the side of the business. I let my partner do that side of the business, and she was very good at that. So she was really the events person. So the logistical was a nightmare, I know, and even hiring people for that night. And we learned a lot, like DJs don't show up, people don't show up, so we have to have backup plan after backup plan. Murphy's Law, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. That was a long haul. I did gym bugs for 10 years. We learned a lot over 10 years. And it was a fully bootstrap business, by the way.
You have a little bit of a overlap between gym bug and easy texting. If you don't mind, outline where were you at towards the end of gym bug? How much revenue were you generating? How many employees did you have on the payroll? And then how did you make that decision to make that transition?
We were doing almost $70 million in revenue towards the end. Ticket sales were a big part of that. And then we also had our recurring software, and we had advertisers like Johnny Walker, Mercedes, those kinds of people who wanted to get to that demographic, especially on our website. We also monetize our email list. You could send out an email about your event or about your product, and we could really target. We were doing really advanced stuff. I can bring men between the ages of 24 and 34 to your Johnny Walker event in New York City or in Philadelphia or in wherever it was, which not too many people were able to do at that time. It was a really big business. But what happened was towards the end, 2005-ish, the efficacy of email started to really dwindle a lot, mainly because we weren't the only email in town. Now we had racks of servers and stuff like that, but now Constant Contact was around, MailChimp was around, people created their own websites. Now you were getting an email from the nightclub, the DJ, the promoter, your grandmother. You were getting emails from everyone. And so we had no way of really cutting through the clutter. But I had a BlackBerry at that time, and BlackBerries were starting to become really popular. And people were texting a lot more in the United States. And we had this database of over a million people. We had their phone numbers. I realized, hey, we need to figure out how to text these people. Again, just like before, there was no off-the-shelf, out-of-the-box solution like a MailChimp or a Constant Contact where it could connect our database, send out mass text messages. And it was as simple as that right now. Using texting right now is much more sophisticated than just sending out a mass text message. And you can do advanced campaigns and stuff like that. But in the beginning, that's all we needed. We just needed a way to send a mass text, and there was nothing like that.
The open rate for texting is insane. Even today, I can't imagine what it was back then. It was almost like back in the day, you were excited to get a piece of mail. You were excited to get a text. You're like, this is a big deal. I have friends.
To make a long story short, I couldn't find it. So I built it, and it took a little while to figure it out because it's not like sending an email. You have to have connectivity into the phone systems. But I believe that we were the first public facing API, SMS API in the United States. But we were definitely the first platform like that SMBs could use to do SMS campaigns, especially through short codes. Right now, people have regular phone numbers, and that's become the norm. And now easy texting does that too. But back then, you couldn't really do it through a regular phone number. You had to do it through short codes. What happened was that I figured it out, and we had this internal tool to do this. And I send out the first text message for our Halloween event. And it was bananas. It was crazy. We hadn't sold so many tickets in a short amount of time than that. It was a problem because our servers couldn't handle it. We weren't ready for that. We had a lot of the club owners and the promoters and everyone on our list. My phone started blowing up and people were like, how did you do that? I want to do that. And the light bulb went off, right? Wow. This is something that other people want. So I started a spreadsheet of who wanted the software, and then the alpha version then became the beta version, which we then decided we're going to give it to other promoters and nightclubs and sell this, and then in a SaaS manner. And in the beginning, it was really funny because we would literally demo them by getting them on the phone and giving them a temporary username and password, and they would have to do it themselves. We would walk them through how to do it. And then once they would send themselves a text message, the close rate was like 99%. They got it. They understood. It was very visceral for them. They type out the text, they press the button, and it comes up on their phone like magic. That's when they open up the wallet and say, we'd have them like sign up through a piece of paper like that they would type out and then fax to us, which is even crazier. And then 2 years into that, I realized that easy texting is a much better business, but especially from the events business is like a 1x1xer. Like it's not worth more than 1 or 2x maybe, because you literally have to reinvent the business every single year. You got to resell tickets. You got to take the upfront risk of renting out the places and the venues, and you can have a bad year. You have a crazy snowstorm or something like that. If I owned it during COVID, I would have been crushed.
Yeah, no kidding. About that. And a buyer's probably looking at you, Shane, and looking at your two businesses, and they're like, I could either buy this event business where I have to roll up my sleeves and host 20 different events on New Year's Eve, and work with nightclub owners and go through initiation, or I could do this text message business that has an insane open rate and everybody wants it and everyone gets it if they send one message.
Intuitive. That wasn't the case at that time. So we sold Junebug to a competitor. So we had a big competitor that was really doing the same things, was in the ticketing business. And he was happy to buy it because we had all the great places and he had come after us and he was always nipping at our deals. So we worked out something and I really wanted to get out anyway because it was taking a really big toll on my life. I wanted to get married. Working that hard and having to go out at night really is not conducive to a serious relationship. Children, the next phase that was for me. Also, I had this like shiny new object, which is easy texting, which arguably is a much better business in my opinion. And so I decided to sell that. And my partner and I went separate ways because he was interested in still doing events. And I just focused 24/7 for another 8 years on easy texting.
You did transition a little bit because you went from having 100 people that you were responsible for. And you found this other company that you can run that can do more volume with only 17.
Few people from Junebug that had stayed with me the entire time, almost that whole 10 years, they came with me to easy texting. And especially my CMO and my assistant and a few other technical people, they came. So it was a group of the core Junebug people that, you know, were tried and true and loyal. And they came and then we built out the team, like the marketing team and stuff like that here. But then we built out the technical team actually in Kiev. I actually physically went to Kiev for 2 or 3 months. I rented an office and we got the best of the best PhD developers that would out code anybody here or just as good as anybody here. We got them for a fraction of the price because it was just not economical to do. CTO is Ukrainian. My wife is Ukrainian. So I had translators and they came with me. As a practical matter, it was the right place for us to go. But as it happened, the young developers there were really culturally very similar to the Western young people. What also helped is that they all had easy texting emails. There was a big easy texting sign. And they didn't feel like they were working for an outsourcing company. Part of the success is that they got the company updates. They got raises just like we did. They had certain marks to hit. And then I would bring people from Ukraine here. We would go there on trips, that kind of thing.
I think it's pretty remarkable because if you think about the best talent in the United States, like where do they go to school? They sometimes go to Ivy Leagues like Harvard, or they go work for a good company like Google. But you have this amazing talent and you can hire the best people in Colombia, in the Philippines, in Ukraine. How did you make the decision that it was the right time to sell? What was that process like for you?
I was running my businesses. It was my career, not really thinking I would sell because, you know, I was doing these like 7, 8, 9, 10 year stints, right? I think coming from a bootstrap mindset, it's very different and you're much more careful about how you spend your money.
There's definitely an advantage to being bootstrapped and it had a big role to play for me as well. You're watching every dollar that goes in and goes out. Your profitability is your funding. That's it entirely.
Yeah.
And so you have to be creative and you have to use what you have.
Yeah, especially in the beginning. When someone wanted to come and buy my business, they'd have to buy it for all cash because like I'm making a lot of money. Like,
yeah.
I'm not going to give up a company that's like throwing off a lot of cash for like stock of some company that I have no idea whether or not it's going to materialize into anything. That was a little bit different about my thing. And then the other thing that I would get counterintuitively, and it's only honestly, if you're talking about 10 years since I more 10 years since I sold the business. And right now, it's a very big business. It's much bigger than when I sold it. It was a company called CallFire. They did essentially what we did for texting, they did for calling. They realized that texting was going to take over calling. And it was very smart on their end to do it because that other part of their business is pretty much gone now. And they even changed their name from CallFire to Easy Texting. What was really crazy when I was showing the business to other potential suitors, they were like, poo-pooing the business, being like, oh, this is like old tech, right? Like, you need to be doing in-app messaging. And I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? It's the only app that's pre-installed on every freaking phone, whether it's a feature phone or a smartphone, right? It's ubiquitous, and its open rates are insane, and everybody uses it.
Whenever you're looking to sell your company, if they're like asking the right questions, do they get the business? Yeah. Do they understand it? Because if they don't, you're like, the employees are going to have our time. This company's not going to reach its full potential.
I'm so happy that MailChimp didn't get it. If they got, they would have crushed me. If they just added texting to their WhatsApp stuff, they would have crushed me. It was my advantage that they didn't know it. Actually, this guy, Ben Chestnut, who sold MailChimp, wrote a whole blog post about how he thought that text messaging was spam and no one would adopt it. And by the way, now Intuit that owns it, they integrated texting into MailChimp, right? So, it's funny, right? So. It's funny.
Didn't he also do a blog article talking about how he wasn't going to sell the business, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, he sold the business?
That's what $10 billion does, right? $10 billion or whatever they into it bought it for, right? Listen, I don't blame him. You know, I would change my mind too if someone gave me $10 billion for my business. Anyway, so how did I decide? I decided because honestly, I was really burnt out. I had been running businesses for 20 years consecutively at that point, and I had made a good amount of money, but I couldn't enjoy it because I was stuck in this rat race. Listen, I'll never put it down because it made me who I am. And that was a great phase of my life. And I learned a lot from it and set the stage for the next 10 years or 20 years of my life.
Like that healthy distance and ego, like you are not your company, but also there has to be a little bit of like sunk cost fallacy, like understanding this isn't the path for me and being willing to make that change or understand your bias.
I'm super obsessed with decision making and like mental biases, and I suffer from it a lot. It also helped me a lot not being stuck in this like one path where you can find success. There's this book that I read that's like Why Greatness Can't Be Planned, The Myth of the Objective. And so they actually, there's two computer scientists that, you know, talk about search algorithms. And if you give the search algorithm an objective and it has to just meet that objective, it never goes through novel paths and it never really ever makes the objective. If you're open to novelty and not being stuck to one objective or one task, then you can go down other paths that may not seem like they're going to get you there, but it does eventually. So I realized for myself, I really wanted to get out if it was time for me. And then that's when I decided to start Neiman Ventures, which essentially is my own family office, because I came to the conclusion that no one's going to really care about my assets and my wealth like I am, and outsourcing that to someone.
I'm wanting to be kicking myself, by the way, if we don't talk about Neiman Ventures and the future of human robotics walking amongst us and the Santa Monica Pier.
I've been trying to learn how to invest for the last 10 years, and I'm still learning. And I made a lot of really bad mistakes, but thankfully I never made a mistake where it took me out of the game. And I think that's the key, is you never bet in such a way that you could get totally wiped out. And a lot of people end up doing that, especially if they have this bias of where they think they know and they can't. The reality is you don't know what you don't know. And I've invested in companies like Convoy, for example, which, you know, when I invested, it was like a $300 million A round or something. It was like, or seed round. And then a few years later, got a $3 billion valuation. And then last year, it just wound down and went to zero. And then I've had like really good exits. There are three main focuses that I do: real estate. So I actually had a lot of real estate exposure before that, because when my business, I come from an immigrant family, grew up in New York. My parents always taught me buy physical assets with whatever money you made. So I had cash flowing businesses. So I would buy real estate, and I had a lot of good real estate understanding from that point of view. The other is like private equity. So I did a lot of private equity type deals where they're more like mature businesses. My passion really is in early stage venture. And I'm pretty agnostic when it comes to the type of early stage. I do I do tech, I do biotech, CPG. We were one of the first investors in Athletic Greens, for example, which is like the least techy thing you can think of. Right. The most recent things that I've done, investments that I've done, is Figure AI, which is a humanoid robot. Last year, when we wanted to go and invest, I brought a bunch of my friends, took a look at the company together. He had built the NBA all-star team of robotics. A bunch of people from Boston Dynamics, from Tesla, from Apple, head of Google DeepMind, like those types of people that he recruited with his own money, his own talent. He had a computer-generated prototype of what he wanted to make, a humanoid robot that would replace or enhance warehouse workers, especially in the pick and pack space. And if you think about it, that's a very good use case for a humanoid robot, because retrofitting a warehouse is way too expensive for people to do. And the world is made to interface with humans. And so right. The easiest thing is to put a human there that does what a human does and can learn what a human does, instead of creating all these other systems that can get the job done that a human should be doing.
Walkways, doors, handles, everything's designed for a human hand, right?
Exactly. He gave his presentation and it was really binary. Either people thought I was batshit crazy and they were like, there's no way he can do this in 1 year and make a prototype that actually works. And, or people bought into it and they're like, he's the next Elon. I was on that side along with a bunch of my other friends. So we did a big investment together. And then a month ago, he did it. Like, he did it. He actually made a prototype that works. It's crazy because it learns through AI. So it watches the movement of people and it can mimic it, and it could do it with just 10 hours. So it can now make a cup of coffee. It could pick and pack. It's starting to do a lot of the things. And he got commercial contracts with Amazon and with BMW. I could talk like hours about this, but just to make a long story short, OpenAI and Microsoft led the next round. NVIDIA came in, Jeff Bezos came in, Amazon came in, Intel came in, and it then became like a huge news. We got a huge markup and we were part of the larger investment as well. So that was a crazy like month that I didn't really sleep. That closed recently, the last week kind of thing. And then another really interesting thing that is totally opposite of that is we purchased the Santa Monica Pier. We bought Pacific Park, which is the entertainment complex of the pier. And that is a 30-year-old business. That's like a Warren Buffett style business that throws off a lot of cash. It's got 12 million visitors a year. It's iconic by virtue of what it is and where it is.
Right. There's only one.
One of one. It's even crazy that we could even buy it. We didn't think that something like this would be purchasable. We got a liquor license for the first time in its 30-year history. So now we're starting to serve alcohol and we're doing a beer garden there. We are doing some other really interesting stuff to make it more like a theme park. The Olympics are coming there in 2028, which gives us an opportunity to increase the amount of visitors that come there. Sponsorships. This would be a great place for a Nike or someone like that to come in and sponsor during the Olympics and the World Cup and those types of things. Just some stats. It's the second most visited tourist destination in Los Angeles. Next to the Hollywood sign, it's the 8th most Instagram place on earth. Assets like this really don't come along very often. And when they do, you got to take advantage of it.
The once in a lifetime asset purchase, right? And if you want to add some novelty, yes. Maybe you can have some AI robots on the Santa Monica Pier serving some hot dogs.
Running the rides.
People will show up for this.
100%. Shane, yeah, that's great.
Where should people find you? Do you have a Twitter handle that you want to send people to?
I'm mostly on Instagram, so it's at Shane Neiman, or you can go to shaneneiman.com. You can email me through there, whichever one is better.
It's been fantastic having you on the pod. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to see what you do next. If that was this past year, let's see what 2024 has in order.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Shane.
That wraps up today's episode. For more inspiring stories and valuable lessons from successful entrepreneurs, be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. Until next time, keep pushing boundaries and writing your next chapter.